Before I begin, I'd like to say what I think many of you were thinking, that that was an absolutely beautiful piece that our choir brought forward this morning. Easily in my top five in the time that I've been here, so thank you. It was a little bit strange, though. They're used to looking at the back of my head, and this time I got to stare at the back of their heads. That was a little bit different. I have shared the story I'm about to share with you before, but I think it is such a good story and so applicable to the message for today that it bears repeating. This is a story that is shared by a notable preacher and author, Bishop Will Willimon. He writes, "At 10, I was minding my business in Miss McDaniel's sixth grade class, dutifully copying words off the blackboard when I got the call. Willimon, Mr. Harrelson, the intimidating ancient principal, says he wants to see you. Go to his office." Shaking with trepidation, I trudged towards the principal's office. Passing an open door, a classmate looked out at me with pity, saying a prayer of thanksgiving that I was summoned to the principal and not him. Ascending the gallows, I went over in my mind all of the possible misunderstandings that could have led to this portentous subpoena. I was only a distant witness to the rock through the gym window incident, in no way a perpetrator or even passive conspirator. "Listen clearly, I do not intend to repeat myself," began Mr. Harrelson. "You, go down Tyndall 2 blocks and turn left. Go 2 more blocks, number 15. I need a message delivered. You tell Jimmy Cole's mother if he's not in school by this afternoon, I'm reporting her to the police for truancy." So this wasn't about me. It was worse. God help me. Jimmy Cole, toughest thug of all of the sixth grader who should have been in the 8th grade. And what's truancy? Pondering these somber thoughts, I journeyed down Tyndall, bidding farewell to the safety of the schoolyard, turned left, walked 2 more blocks, marveling that the world actually went on about its business while we were doing time in school each day. The last 2 blocks were the toughest, descending into a not all nice part of town, terra incognita to me, what was left of a sad neighborhood hidden behind the school. Number 15 was a small house, peeling paint, disordered yard, just the sort of house you'd expect Jimmy Cole to be holed up in, rough looking, small but sinister. There was a big blue Buick parked in front. As I fearfully approached the walk, a man emerged, letting the front door slam, stepped off the porch, and began adjusting his tie, putting on his coat. I approached him with, "Are you Mr. Cole, sir?" Just then I remembered that everybody at school said that Jimmy was so mean because he didn't have a daddy. The man looked down at me, pulled his tie on tight, and guffawed, "Mr. Cole?" Laughing, he just left me standing there, got into his car, and then sped off. I had to wait until I was in the 8th grade before someone whispered to me the dirty word for what Jimmy's mother did for a living, and until my Boy Scout Court of Honor before I realized the man I met that day was a member of the city council. I stepped up on the rotten porch and knocked on the soiled screen door. My heart sank when it was opened by none other than Jimmy Cole, whose steely eyes enlarged when he saw me. Before Jimmy could say anything, the door was pulled more open, wide, and a woman in a faded blue terry cloth bathrobe looked down at me over Jimmy's shoulder. "What do you want?" she asked in a cold, threatening tone as I marveled at the sight of a mother in a bathrobe, even though it was early afternoon. I'm from the school. The principal sent me to..." "The principal? What does that old fool want?" "Well, he sent me to say that that everybody at school misses Jimmy and wishes he was there today." "What?" she sneered, pulling Jimmy toward her just a bit. "It's like a special day today and everyone wants Jimmy there. I think that's what he said." Jimmy, the feared thug who could beat up any kid at Donaldson Elementary, even 9th graders, any time he wanted, indeed had on multiple occasions, peered out at me in wonderment. Suddenly, this tough hood, feared by all, looked small, being clutched by his mother's protective arm, his eyes pleading, embarrassed, hanging on my every stammering word. "Well, you tell that old man it's none of his business what I do with James." "James," she said, looking down at him, "you want to go to that old school today or not?" Jimmy looked at me as he wordlessly nodded assent. "Well, go get your stuff, and take that dollar off the dresser to buy lunch. I ain't got nothing here." In a flash, he was away and back. His mother stood at the door, and after making the unimaginable gesture of giving Jimmy a peck on the cheek, stood staring at us as we walked off the porch, down the walk, and back toward Tyndall Avenue. As we walked back toward the school, we said not a word to one another. I had previously lacked the courage to speak to Jimmy the Hood, and Jimmy the Tough had never had any reason, thank the Lord, to speak to me. And walking back to school that afternoon was certainly not the time to begin. We walked up the steps to the school, took a right, and wordlessly turned toward the principal's office. I led him in, handed him off to the principal's secretary, who received my ward. For the first time, Jimmy seemed not mean and threatening at all, but rather very small. As the secretary led him away, Jimmy turned and looked at me with a look of, I don't know, maybe regret, maybe embarrassment, or rescue. But I guess it could have been thanks, gratitude. That evening, when I narrated my day to my mother at supper, she said, "That is the most outrageous thing I've ever heard. Sending a young child out in the middle of the day to fetch a truant. And on that street, Mr. Harrelson ought to have his head examined. Don't you ever allow anyone to put you in that position again, sending a child." But I knew that my mother was wrong. That day was the best day of my whole time at Donaldson Elementary. Preparation for the rest of my life. My first experience of a God who thinks nothing of commandeering ordinary folk and handing them outrageous assignments. That day, walking down Tyndall Avenue, was dress rehearsal for a summer night 2 decades later, when I knelt before a bishop and he laid hands on and pronounced the words, "You, go down Tyndall 2 blocks and turn left, and go 2 more blocks, number 15. I need a message delivered." Friends, our God is a sending God. And then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Remarkably, choosing to use the children of God, you and me, like so many before, to do the work of God's kingdom. This, of course, is nothing new. It has been God's MO since the beginning of time, sending men and women into the world to be the bearers of judgment and of favor, to share with one another the good news of God's love. But lest we think this is some Pollyanna notion, I want you to hear what follows for Isaiah. God said, "Go and say to this people, keep listening, but do not comprehend. Keep looking, but do not understand. Make the mind of this people dull, and stop their ears and shut their eyes, so that they may not look with their eyes and listen with their ears and comprehend with their minds and turn and be healed." But then I said, "How long, O Lord?" And he said, "Until cities lie waste without inhabitant and houses without people, and the land is utterly desolate, until the Lord sends everyone far away, and vast is the emptiness in the midst of the land. Even if a tenth part remains in it, it will be burned again like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains standing when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump." Clearly, not all sending is to ease and safety or comfort and popularity. Sometimes God even sends to where there is danger, where God knows it and we know it. Nevertheless, the voice calls, "Go on your way." We have encountered this truth time and time again in the Scriptures. Abraham and Moses and Jeremiah and many, many more. But this call story, the story of Isaiah's call, is a bit different. In most every other call story in the scriptures, God speaks to one person with a directive specific to that person. To Abraham, God said, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." To Moses, God said, "There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flames of fire from within a bush. And Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. And God called to him from within the bush, 'Moses, Moses.' And Moses said, 'Here I am.' The Lord said, 'I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt.' To Jeremiah, the word of the Lord came, saying, 'Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations.' The Lord said to me, 'Do not say I am too young. You must go to everyone I send you to and say whatever I command you. Do not be afraid of them, for I am with you, and I will rescue you, declares the Lord.'" Each one of them called by name, each given a specific task. But that is not the case with Isaiah. Here a call goes out broadly, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" Waiting response from any who would dare to answer. And it is Isaiah who speaks. "Here am I, send me." Without knowing what the task is that lies ahead, he volunteers his service. "Send me," he says. And it occurs to me that this is probably more like our experience than many of the other call stories of the Bible. For few of us have heard God's voice in a literal sense, let alone out of a burning bush, calling our name out specifically, Alan, Chad, Lita. More likely, when we have received a call to serve, it has been a bit more broad. More like, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" And then that door is open. And we have a choice. When the call comes, "Who will go?" we decide whether or not to answer, whether or not to follow. We can stay where we are, safe and comfortable and predictable, right here or in our homes. Or we can go. Go as we are called. Unknown, unpredictable, perhaps even unsafe. It also occurs to me that we rarely hear this call with our ears. Rather, more often than not, we sense it with our hearts. And therein lies the challenge. Because if we don't hear it with our ears unmistakably, but rather sense it in the depths of our hearts, then it is a bit easier, at least at first, to ignore it. Maybe we're just sensing it wrong. Nobody else will know if I don't do it. You know, I have so much else to do first. It can wait. But that feeling persists. And the healthy sense of guilt sets in. "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" repeats over and over again in our hearts. And no one else has answered that call. And finally, you feel that urge to speak up and say, "Here am I. Send me." Just like Isaiah did, and so many as well. Here's the truth, friends. Each one of us has been sent. Because it is part of our Christian DNA. The moment that you signed on to be a disciple of Christ, you were marked as a missionary. Whether it be to Jimmy Cole's house, or the mission field in India, to Baltimore or Mars Hill, North Carolina, or to your neighbor's house, or to the closest homeless shelter. Wherever it may be, you have been sent as well. Friends, it is simply not enough just to come here to this place week after week for worship and meetings and events. For we are not just a gathered in people. We are also a sent out people. Whom shall I send? And who will go for us? The Lord still asks those questions. And how will we answer? Here am I. Send me. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.